Moncrief on News Talk.
Sponsored by Avantcard. With personalised pricing, our rates are made for you.
53106 is our text number that will cost you 30 cents. Jonathan de Burka Butler joins us again, once again, to bring us news from other parts of the planet. Jonathan, good afternoon to you.
Sean, how are you doing?
Right, Kazakhstan, we're going to go to now, where this is a story about a whistleblower who's going to be put on trial.
Yes, this is an individual by the name of Serikjan Bilash. And Serikjan Bilash was in fact born in China, okay, but he is ethnically Kazakh, okay. So okay. Just to put you in the picture, there's about 18 and a half people live in Kazakhstan, and most of them are ethnic Kazakhs, obviously. But there's about 1.5 million, if not a bit more, ethnic Kazakhs who live in China. And they live in Xinjiang. Now, Xinjiang might ring a bell with you because that's a province that we've mentioned before. Generally, when we talk about it, it's in the northwest of the country of China. It's in the northwest of China, I should say. And normally when we talk about it, we're dealing with the Chinese Uyghurs, who, of course, are the Muslim minority in China, but they would be the majority group in that particular province. And they've been having a particularly bad time in recent years.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, some of it might be argued, has been brought on by some of the people who purport to represent them, because there has been terrorist attacks further down in the south in China and that kind of thing. But the Chinese, it has to be said, have taken the opportunity to, they say, re-educate the Chinese Uyghurs. And that's basically, this is, you know, NGOs, the United States, China tried to deny this initially, but now they're saying, yes, we are doing it, but we're doing it because we want to put these people into re-education camps, they call them. But effectively, it's to stop them becoming terrorists. And there's, depending on who you read and what you read, there's anything between 800,000 and about 1 million or 1.1 million people in these re-education camps, right?
Okay.
And so where does this Kazakh individual come in? Well, Kazakhs are also being put into these re-education camps, and that's something that's not been spoken about an awful lot. And obviously because China has such an influence on the region, and obviously because Kazakhstan borders China, the Chinese authorities are putting pressure on the authorities in Kazakhstan to put pressure on the individuals in Kazakhstan that might be highlighting this situation, if you get me.
I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So that's exactly what's happening. 5 months ago, this individual was arrested, and his trial started on Monday. Now, we're not 100% sure what could happen to him. I mean, he's been held in pre-trial detention, albeit under house arrest, with his family for the last 5 months. His trial, as I said, started yesterday. And it's basically, the accusations come from Chinese officials that he's fabricated the cases that he's highlighting in Kazakhstan. And the Kazakhs themselves are saying that he's basically causing disharmony. He has, in various different statements, mentioned jihad also. But in his defence, he has said that they're talking about information jihad, and not, as his wife said, you know, getting a gun and going down to Syria. So,
right, okay,
you
know,
this is what he's...
At the same time, it's a very loaded term nowadays.
It is, and that is a problem for him,
So it sounds as if the Kazakh authorities are just doing what the Chinese want them to do.
That's essentially it in a nutshell, I would suggest. Yeah, absolutely.
So how much longer will this all go on for until he's actually... Until he's found guilty,
yeah,
as we all expect.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, who knows? It's how long is a piece of string is one of those situations. So I don't know if there's any... We've been given any guideline as to when, how long this is going to go on for. I mean, already the trial has been moved from the capital city to another city, Almaty, where the crime is supposed to have taken place. So they're already changing things.
Any indication when he's found guilty, what kind of sentence he might receive?
Not sure as yet. There's no indication that I've seen what kind of sentence he might get.
Right.
But I could imagine it could be relatively stiff.
Yeah.
I mean, he has been fined before,
but
it was only a fine of about $700, but this could be far worse.
Okay, well, if it's a second offence, they'll probably take that into account. Right, Kenya we're going to go to next, and the finance minister there has been arrested.
Yes, this is an individual by the name of Henry Rotich. Now, Henry Rotich, as you said, is the finance minister. He was arrested on Monday on corruption and fraud charges, And he was arrested along with 27 other top officials. And it basically concerns contracts that were awarded around two mega issues, or mega issues, mega dams, that were awarded 4 years ago, I think. And he has been found to not really be looking after the interests of Kenyans, shall we say, in awarding of these contracts.
Right, okay. And how much hard evidence is there that he was doing this?
Okay, so there's a bit, to be honest with you. So according to the contract, the project was to cost a total of about $450 million. Okay, but the Treasury then increased the amount by $164 million. Okay, now bearing in mind that this contract was issued, as I said, 4 years ago, $180 million of that has already been paid out. But there's been hardly any construction, and there was 6 million. It's laughable, really. There's 6 million has been spent on resettlement, but nobody has actually been resettled, and worse, no land has actually been acquired yet. So it doesn't look good for him.
Right.
And I suppose it's all part of a crackdown that's been going on over the last couple of years around corrupt officials and money that's going missing.
Well, is there? Have they arrested Henry because Henry's like, the book stops here, or Henry is, you know, driving a really nice car all of a sudden?
And just in case anybody's tuned in, we're not talking about Henry McKean.
It's Henry
Rotich.
He drives a lovely car.
He does indeed. Finance Minister. He's been arrested because they have this evidence against him that he's been caught up in these, awarding these contracts to an Italian company, actually, called CMC di Ravenna, and he shouldn't have been. So they seem to have enough evidence against him to bring a case. And interestingly, there's news just in about this, that they've actually, an arrest warrant for the CEO of that Italian company has actually been issued as well. His name is Paolo Porcelli. So in all my years here, the inevitable question is, do they have an extradition agreement? Yeah. Which I know you're going to ask. Yeah. And I looked it up, and they do. So he could well be sent. Yeah, he could well be sent.
That would be very interesting if they did actually extradite him. Nigeria Air Force has promoted an officer who returned 41 grand. I suppose this is the other side of the coin, really, isn't it?
It is indeed. And it's interesting that they're making such a big deal out of this. This got, you know, wide coverage in the Nigerian media and also in the world. This was an aircraft man, Bashir Umar, who found 37,000 euros, I think it was, in a parcel at an international airport in Kano, which is a big city up in the north of Nigeria. So he was on his rounds there. I don't know why he'd been deployed there, but he was walking around, found the 37 grand, found a phone number attached to it, strangely enough, and got in contact with the individual who had this 37 grand
in cash in an airport
in Nigeria.
That's not suspicious at all.
But anyway, it raises more questions than it answers in many respects. But anyway, he returned it to the individual, and he's been promoted. He's been promoted two steps. So he is now a corporal, I believe, in the Nigerian Air Force. Yeah, no word on where the 37 grand came from or necessarily the name of the individual who had the money, owned the money, was given, but I don't know who he was as such.
Yeah, it's a lovely story, which just prompts a hell of a lot more questions.
It does, really,
doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I suppose this is West Africa more in general, but the fight against piracy.
Yes, so as you know, there's a terrible problem around piracy in this part of the world, in the Gulf of Guinea, which is in West Africa, along where Nigeria, Togo, Benin, places like that are. There's interesting statistics around it, actually. The International Maritime Bureau says that that area is the most dangerous sea in the world for piracy, right? So the statistics, 73% of all sea kidnappings and 92% of hostage takings occur in that particular spot. That's across the world.
Right.
And armed pirates have kidnapped 27 crew members in the first half of 2019 alone. So this particular move by ECOWAS, which is a kind of a European Union style thing, involving 15 countries in this region, they've decided to come together to tackle this big problem in the area. So we'll see how they get on.
Yeah, because I was kind of under the vague impression that the amount of attacks in that general area had gone down a bit for various reasons, but because many of them, if they're registered in European or American ports, they have armed people on private security at the very least on board.
You're right, absolutely. And Nigeria had in fact reported that, and we're trying to put a decent slant on this. They said that they had 22 attacks in 2018 in the same period, and in the first half of 2019 they've only had 14 attacks. So you're right that the numbers had gone down, but it seems that they're on the rise a little bit again. And this was prompted significantly, I think, by a specific attack earlier in the month on a Turkish ship, where the pirates actually boarded the ship, and instead of taking the ship, they took the people off it.
Yeah.
And kidnapped them, which seems, I think, is a kind of a new tactic. They left 8 sailors on board, and they've taken 10 away, and there's been nothing heard of them since. So, as I said, this group have now decided to cooperate with each other, so Nigerian boats will be able to dock in Togo or wherever it is, and vice versa.
It's using joint, to tackle the problem. Joint facilities.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's bad press for these countries when things like this happen.
Yeah.
So they've always got to be seen to be doing something.
Yeah. Right. Italy, we're going to go to you next. And a policeman has been stabbed.
Yeah, it's a very tragic story, actually. This is the case of Officer Mario Rega, who's a 35-year-old carabinieri. There's a few strands to this story, actually, that are relatively interesting. It happened last week, as far as I know. I'll cut a long story short. Basically, two individuals, an 18-year-old and a 19-year-old from California, were over on their holidays, and they tried to get some cocaine, okay?
Mm.
They asked an individual for cocaine, and they turned out to be duds, all right? They later went back to this same individual, and they stole his bag, and they obviously had some sort of a contact with him, because they were then able to call him, and they left a threatening message basically saying that they wanted 100 euros and a gram of cocaine in order for this Italian individual to get his bag back. Okay?
Yeah.
So he then reported that to the police. They went back to the two American individuals, and a sting was set up. And this particular individual, this 35-year-old carabinieri, Italian policeman, was involved in that particular sting. When the teenagers came to meet them, they had apparently armed themselves with a knife. And they got into a fight, and this 35-year-old policeman was stabbed and died as a consequence. Now, there was initial reports around this were kind of frightening. Because there was an assumption made around the initial reports. Two North Africans had been seen leaving the area.
Mm.
Now, that was the story for the first couple of hours of this. And you're just thinking to yourself, I lived in the place, so I know what it's like.
Yeah.
I was thinking to myself, please, no, don't be North Africans, because that's just feeding into the Lega Nord and all of their claptrap that they come out with. So, it was discovered then by watching CCTV footage that it was these two individuals. They were tracked, and then witnesses came forward and said that they had seen the scuffle and obviously what resulted happening. Photos then came out, I don't know if you heard about this, of one of the suspects being blindfolded in what looked like to be a police station. So having been arrested, the police who were involved in their arrest might well have done their case a hell of a lot of damage here by if this proves to be correct.
And why did they blindfold them?
Well, that remains to be seen. But all I can tell you is that these two individuals have now confessed to the murder. So if a confession was made, but it can be proved that this confession was made under duress, I don't know how watertight.
Yeah.
Do you know that's going to be? I mean, there's some people that are some people in the media are already comparing it to Guantanamo Bay or images that look like Guantanamo Bay.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah. Well. Yeah. Picture. As you say, the immediate idea of two West Africans. The visuals.
Yeah.
People just fill in the gaps themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oftentimes. And these are what, 18 and 19. They're still kids, really.
Yeah.
Have they made a plea? Are they cooperating? Or what stance are they taking?
At the moment, they have spoken to lawyers, but one of the clients was one of the lawyers said that his client was tired, and that all they know so far is that they have made this confession. But beyond that, I don't know more, to be honest with you.
Okay, right. Brazil, we're going to go to now, and an indigenous leader has been killed by miners, as in under the ground miners, not underage
people.
Absolutely.
So this is a story which centres in the state of Amapá. So that's right in the northeast of the country on the border with Suriname. And it's sort of focused on an area which is a reserve, all right? It's about 600,000 acres. It's the size of Galway, okay? It's a reserve that's the size of Galway, where mining is not allowed to take place, right? So it's protected under Brazilian federal law. Miners can't go in there, but of course they do go into these places all the time, and they, you know, independently. And we'll look at maybe the reasons why that's on the increase in a few minutes. But to go back to the story, on Wednesday, a body of an indigenous leader was found in a river near his village, and he had been stabbed to death, right? So a couple of days after that, other locals then spotted individuals in the area who shouldn't really have been there, right? So this is a group of an ethnic tribe that basically only like people to come into their area when they're invited. Okay,
yes,
they're very
yeah.
private, and they have good reason to be, because they were nearly wiped out in the 1970s by prospectors coming in and spreading disease, right? So they don't really want that happened again, and there's only about 1,500 of them left, okay? So those particular people who spotted the strangers, let's call them that in this instance, coming into their village, they moved to a bigger village to be closer to more individuals, and then shots were fired subsequently in that particular village. So reports have now come out, and an estimated 50 miners have moved into the area and are basically trying to frighten the indigenous groups that live there out, so that they can go in then and carry out whatever work they feel they should be doing.
It doesn't sound like these. But would these miners be, if they are miners, representing a company of some sort, or are they just doing it off their own bat?
Again, it's very hard to know, right? So nobody's been in here for years. Nobody's gone in this capacity into this part of the world for years looking for things, because they haven't been allowed to. And it's thought that basically because of certain things that Mr. Bolsonaro has been saying, such as that the people who live in these areas are prehistoric men, and that he has called on third countries to come into this part of the world and see what value they can get out of the land that these prehistoric men are occupying, is that that's giving license to people to say, if we go into these areas and we do this, nobody's going to prosecute us, we won't be thrown in jail. Whereas before, that wasn't the case.
What is there?
Gold.
For money. All right, okay. And so, yeah, I don't know anything about gold mining, but maybe individuals could go in and just do it themselves.
Could well
but
be
I'm
the
thinking
case.
Of old Westerns where people are panning in rivers and stuff.
Absolutely.
I imagine it's probably a bit more sophisticated than that. Has there been any state response to this to protect the area? Because obviously what these people are doing is illegal.
Yes, so it's very hard to access, but these people do have representatives. So there's an organisation there called FUNAI who look after these people, and obviously they have contacts that they can make with the outside world, and they do that. So they have sent messages to the outside world, basically to police, and police are on their way to try and sort out the situation, because the worry also for these 50, let's say, if that's what they are, 50 miners who've gone into the area, is that this tribe will organise and they'll go after them. And they'll kill them.
Yeah. Perhaps in a way that kind of then would enable
a response
state
on the
forces
other side.
To come in.
Absolutely.
Then, yeah. Right. Finally, we're going to go to Puerto Rico. Now, I think this has been going on for a while, and finally he's given in.
Yes. So this is the governor of Puerto Rico, a man by the name of Ricardo Rosello. So he announced on Wednesday that he was going to resign on August the 2nd, 3 days whenever that is. Now, this basically comes after, as you rightly said, about 2 weeks of protest off the back of federal authorities who carried out anti-corruption raids on some of his associates. But I think more strongly, or the real reason that people went out onto the streets, is because it was revealed in newspapers and across the media that he had been saying pretty nasty stuff about people in a WhatsApp group that was confined to himself and other well-to-do Puerto Ricans.
Right.
Okay. So
somebody was leaking this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So he was saying things about a political opponent that he described as a lady of the night, shall we say, but in a far more derogatory manner. Poking fun at an obese man, apparently, who's, again, I think, a political opponent. And he was joking about feeding a cadaver from the island's backlog morgue to a critic of his. And that, I think, is probably something that really touched a nerve with people, given that they are still suffering from the consequences of Hurricane Irma and Maria, I think it was, that happened in 2017. They still haven't recovered from that, and they're looking at their island and basically saying it's in a heap and this guy's making jokes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the interesting parallel here was that, remember, Donald Trump visited and said, everything's grand, here's a few toilet rolls. Yeah. And what are they all complaining about? But turns out that their local guy on the ground was doing something similar.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't taking the situation seriously and was just shown to be out of touch. And, you know, it was gas because his first response was to say, well, I'll resign as president of this organisation and I won't stand for them. You know, it seems to be the done thing now, where when you're in trouble, you say, well, I'll resign as this and I won't stand for the next one, but I want to stay on in my job.
Yeah.
In this case, the Puerto Ricans went out, or those who were protesting against him went out, and they kind of doubled down. More of them went out and said, no, we want to get rid of you. And he finally buckled under the pressure. So he is gone.
Right. OK. And were there austerity measures as well that he was responsible for?
I think that people believe that the measures that have been taken and that he was responsible for weren't adequate in terms of what should have been done for the general populace.
Right. OK. Well, so what should we look out for in the coming week, Jonathan?
OK, so Mike Pompeo is on a tour of Asia, Southeast Asia, specifically on Australia in the coming week. World Breastfeeding Week starts on Thursday, I think.
Woo-hoo!
And then Prime Minister Johnson, I have down here in my notes, will be doing stuff somewhere, no doubt, is what I put down in my notes here. I think he's in Wales today, isn't he? And he's in Northern Ireland tomorrow.
Yeah. He's certainly not talking to any European leaders until everybody caves in and does exactly what he wants. Right, Jonathan, thanks a million for coming in with Jonathan DeBurka Butler there. We'll take a break, back in a few minutes.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Sponsored by Avant Card. With personalised pricing, our rates are made for you.